Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with a CBS World News Roundup. HEW Secretary Joseph Califano makes a speech in New York today, and he's expected to outline President Carter's long-awaited position on national health insurance. Barry Serafin in Washington takes an advanced look.
According to various sources, President Carter, after months of trying to decide what kind of approach to take to national health insurance, has now made his decision. The administration plans to ask Congress for limited rather than comprehensive insurance legislation. Mr. Carter is expected to at some point lay out a blueprint for a comprehensive, so-called cradle-to-grave insurance program, but for now, seek a more restricted approach. Not as restricted, however, as a bill introduced by Senate Finance Committee Chairman Russell Long, providing only for protection against catastrophic illness or injury. In sampling congressional opinion, the administration has found little inclination to push an expensive, comprehensive plan, such as long advocated by Senator Edward Kennedy and organized labor. Exactly what will be in the administration's proposal, what kind of coverage would be provided, how much it would cost, how it would be financed, has yet to be spelled out. An actual legislative proposal may be weeks, even months away. The chances in Congress for any kind of health insurance plan are considered slim. Hospital cost control legislation, such as that introduced by the Carter administration, is seen as an essential first step if there is to be national health insurance. Barry Serafin, CBS News, Washington.
A Senate Appropriations Subcommittee chaired by Senator William Proxmire takes testimony today from high officials of the Environmental Protection Agency. They'll be asked for their reactions to a committee staff report alleging widespread misuse of travel privileges by agency officials while on official business. Proxmire says travel by federal officials is a tremendously expensive activity. It costs billions of dollars, and there is undoubtedly, he says, not only in the EPA but in other agencies as well, some very questionable travel. It was almost dawn in Jerusalem when the Israeli parliament finally did what everyone knew it would do. It approved the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty. Bob McNamara reports how it came out.
28 unprecedented hours of debate led to the historic vote, and just about every Knesset speaker voiced hopes and doubts about peace, whether it could last and where it might lead. The last few speakers were men who had actively negotiated the treaty. Defense Minister Weizmann, Foreign Minister Dayan, and then Prime Minister Begin. Begin's remarks were disjointed, not because it was 3 o'clock in the morning, but because of all the heckling, the shouting, and the chamber speaker banging the gavel for order. When it was quiet, Begin called Egypt's president Sadat courageous. He called Arab leaders who condemned the treaty a pack of wolves, and he said the moment was a turning point in relations between two Middle East nations. At 4 a.m., the vote came, a show of hands, not a roll call. The hands counted. It was 95 for the peace treaty, 18 against it. Most of the opposition from the right wing of Begin's own party. As the chamber cleared, Begin and Moshe Dayan just sat there as if stunned. Israel's parliament had just ratified its first peace treaty with an Arab state. Bob McNamara, CBS News, Jerusalem.
President Sadat this morning called the Knesset action marvelous. President Carter said the Knesset spoke with a voice heard around the world, the voice of peace. The volume of Arab voices raised against the Israeli-Egyptian treaty is rising as Arab League members prepare to meet in Baghdad. Hal Walker has the story in Beirut, Lebanon.
The Conference of Arab States Foreign and Economic Ministers has been called for next Tuesday in the Iraqi capital to translate into action the measures against Egyptian President Anwar Sadat approved last November by the Arab League summit. The date was set to follow the expected signing of the peace treaty on Monday. Chief among the sanctions against President Sadat is the call for an economic, political, and military boycott once the treaty is executed. From around the Arab world have come stronger and stronger denunciations of the bilateral agreement. Jordan's King Hussein, in a newspaper interview, has accused the United States of arm-twisting to try to gain his support of the treaty, which he says he will not give. Iraq has warned that the treaty could provoke another Mideast war. From Qatar has come a request that the issue be placed before the United Nations, and the Palestine news agency WAFA, in a commentary, likened support of the treaty to siding with oppression and slavery. Hal Walker, CBS News, Beirut.
One Beirut newspaper, however, says the proposed sanctions contain loopholes that would allow the oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia to maintain their economic assistance to Egypt. Saudi leaders have reportedly assured Cairo that they will continue such aid, regardless of the peace treaty. Efforts continue in Iran today to work out a reconciliation between the new provisional government and Kurdish rebels demanding greater control over regional affairs. Bill Plant reports from Tehran.
Iran's revolutionary government is making an attempt to come to some sort of understanding with rebellious Kurdish tribesmen who live in the northwestern part of the country. Ayatollah Talahani, an Iranian religious leader and representative of Ayatollah Khomeini, arrived today in the Kurdish town of Sanandaj to meet with local officials. Though a ceasefire is supposed to have been in effect for the past 2 days in Sanandaj, observers on the scene report that shots are still being exchanged between members of the Iranian army penned up in their large garrison and Kurds in the town. Two F-4 Phantom jets belonging to the Iranian Air Force flew low over the town today. Some claimed that they strafed it, but eyewitnesses say they are not certain whether there was any shooting. The dispute between the Kurds and the government centers on their desire for some kind of regional autonomy, and it is a serious test of the new government's authority. Bill Plant, CBS News, Tehran.
The British ambassador to the Netherlands, 58-year-old Sir Richard Sykes, was assassinated this morning at The Hague. He was shot by gunmen who opened fire as he left home for the embassy. A 19-year-old footman was also shot. They were rushed to a hospital where they died a short while later. The gunman escaped on foot. No motive has been established. Dutch police say the ambassador had received no threats on his life. Police in El Salvador early today found the body of a wealthy Salvadorian businessman who was kidnapped 2 months ago by leftist rebels. The leftists had demanded the release of political prisoners and other concessions from El Salvador's government in exchange for his release, and they set a deadline of 7 o'clock last night. The demands were not met, so the businessman was shot and killed. The rebels are still holding a Japanese businessman and two British bankers and are threatening to kill them, too. Increasingly, as concern mounts about the energy supply, shortages of gasoline are cropping up here and there around the country. Rich Holter of station WCCO cites some examples in Minnesota.
Some Minnesota service station operators complained their March gasoline allocations were 50% below what they needed. And with 10 days left in the month, many of those service stations are now running out of gas. A Service Station Association survey shows one out of four Minnesota service stations will close early this Saturday and remain closed on Sunday in an effort to stretch the dwindling gasoline supplies. The weekend closing figure is expected to be even higher on the last weekend of the month. The situation will improve with the shipment of April allocations, but industry officials are predicting the cycle will be repeated over and over through the summer months. And gasoline may not be the only petroleum problem facing Minnesotans this year. One industry official says if crude oil shipments don't increase and President Carter fails to come up with an effective energy conservation program, a lot of heating oil tanks will come up empty in the fall. Rich Holter for CBS News, Minneapolis.
The jury in the Huey Newton murder trial resumes deliberations today in Oakland, California, and we'll hear about it from Bernard Goldberg.
The jurors heard closing arguments for most of the day yesterday and deliberated briefly yesterday evening before retiring for the night. The trial lasted 3 weeks, Newton testifying in his own defense that on the August night in 1974, when the 17-year-old prostitute was shot, he was at home, writing. But a friend of the slain girl, an admitted former prostitute herself, testified that she saw Newton shoot the girl. But then, 11 days later, in a dramatic turnaround, she took the stand again, this time called by the defense. And this time, she said she made a mistake, that she never saw Newton shoot anybody. Another witness, Carlos Bowie, testified he had been selling marijuana to prostitutes the night of the shooting and that he saw Newton pull the trigger. But in another twist, Newton's bodyguard testified that he also saw the shooting and it was Bowie, Newton's accuser, who really fired the weapon. Newton faces a possible life sentence if convicted. Bernard Goldberg, CBS News, Oakland, California.
Private First Class Robert Garwood, a 33-year-old U.S. Marine, is on his way home now from Vietnam to face charges that he defected during the Vietnam War and bore arms against the United States. Garwood was released by the Hanoi government and arrived in Bangkok, Thailand this morning. He was captured by the Viet Cong in 1965. On advice of the Consul General, he declined to answer questions on his arrival in Bangkok.